Hey guys, thanks for joining us for this 149th episode in Season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. Special guests on this episode include director Jesse Moss, has a new documentary, Mayor Pete, which will be available this Friday on Amazon Prime. We'll also visit with guitarist extraordinaire Jesse Dayton. We'll talk about the new book and accompanying soundtrack for Bow Monster, available now. We'll also visit with our friend of the show, singer and songwriter Bly. Got a new single, Lucky Star, also an upcoming single release party this Saturday at the 104 in Tipton, Oklahoma. And we'll visit with singer and songwriter Jason Bird, whose new single, Better Life, is actually a duet with the late, great George Jones. If you would, please take the time to subscribe, comment, leave some feedback, check out the shop, and share with your friends. Now, no matter where you stand on cancel culture stuff, this stat can't be good for the whole freedom of speech thing. A new study found Americans are more afraid to speak their mind than ever before. 90% of people said that they've held back at least once in the past 18 months because they felt it would be emotionally or physically unsafe to say what they were really thinking. And the two topics we're most intimidated to talk about are politics and the pandemic. Now, in the last year and a half, 47% of us have avoided someone so our opinions wouldn't clash. 19% have pretended to agree with a statement we disagreed with, and 14% have stopped talking to someone we didn't see eye to eye with. And since I've been holding this in for long, I'm gonna just go ahead and get out there and say it. People who tuck in their sweaters, they have a sickness. I was actually just watching the trailer myself of the new documentary, Mayor Pete. We've got director Jesse Moss with us today. And first off, Jesse, I appreciate you taking some time to be on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, when did this idea, the documentary idea, first come to you? How were you approached with the idea for the documentary?
It was March 2019. Pete had not even officially announced he was running for president. He was thinking about it. He had a staff of four at the time. So pretty small campaign, pretty presumptuous idea. 37-year-old mayor of South Bend decides he's going to run for president. But I knew Pete was a rising star in the party, and he was open to giving us access. And that's everything as a documentary filmmaker, you know, access. And I thought, wow, if we could get a ringside seat and this guy's for real, which he seems like he might be, I don't think he's going to go far, but let's kick the tires and see what happens. And man, that thing caught fire pretty fast. And it became an exciting story. And we got a ringside seat.
And as a documentarian, I mean, I'm sure you have delved into the idea of politics and elections and stuff like that before. But following as a documentarian, how much different, how much eye-opening was it for you this time around?
Well, I usually, as a documentary filmmaker, try to stay far away from campaigns. You know, they're really, really, candidates are hard to cover. They're super guarded. Campaign events, you know, you have to be in the back of the room on a press riser with the camera pointed far away at the candidate on a stage who gives a kind of a canned speech. And it's like, well, where's the news? And I didn't want to do that. I wanted to be like with the candidate all the time. And that's what we got. And that is fascinating, I think, particularly because Pete's for real. We know that now he's in the administration, got a huge portfolio. But we see him take off, the campaign take off, the message starts to resonate in places like Iowa, New Hampshire. Campaign staff grows from 4 to 400. Suddenly he's being taken really seriously and the stakes get high. We're in debate preparation with him. How do you prepare for these big TV debates with campaign senior staff at home with him and his husband, Chasten, which is a big part of the story that we discovered. I hadn't anticipated that I would be making something of a love story, frankly, but his connection with Chasten is deep and complicated, and they're very different kinds of people. You know, a gay man on the national stage running a presidential campaign, his relationship, his identity, these were all kind of important things that he was talking about and that he led us into seeing in the film. And I think that's part of the complexity of the story, is not just what's happening politically, but what's happening personally and how he's balancing the two of them.
For you, what did covering the election, following it like you did, what did that teach you about the country that we live in and the people that we live right beside?
I wanted to make the film because I think we're all wondering what our political future is. You know, it seems like there's a lot of turbulence. a lot of division. How are we going to move forward? How are we going to fix the big problems we have? Who are the people who are going to help us do that? You know, whether you're Democrat, Republican, whatever your party persuasion, I think we all would like a functional way forward. And, you know, I wasn't here to promote Pete's campaign. I'm not here now. I wanted to make a film about this conversation. I think Pete's having that conversation as a candidate. You know, he's got a pretty interesting background, and he does come from Middle America. He's a Navy vet, you know, worked hard in this working class community to turn it around. And these are, in a way, the problems of America writ small, he's confronted. And I thought, well, let's see how Pete deals with this, whether his message resonates. You know, he's not the single answer to all of our problems, but I do think a healthy politics is something we probably would all agree we need. And how do we get there? Who are the people that help us get there? That's an important conversation. I think that's in part what the film is about. And hopefully people who come to the movie will, you know, it'll help them consider those questions.
Jesse, how many evolutions of the idea did it take before the final product was released? How many different iterations of it for you?
I wish it was easier. And, you know, the funny thing is with the campaign, we knew the outcome. Like, we knew he lost, right? We knew what the high points and the low points were. We'd shot all of this stuff for a year. We had everything that we'd photographed, but it's just, editing a documentary is like always, there's no shortcuts. And it took us another year to really write that story. And I think one of the things, we had to get past the election. All of us had to get through that election and to be able to look back and say, okay, what really matters here? And that was perspective we didn't have, but we needed. We just had to work our way through it. And I think you'll see in the film, it's really a balance of the personal and the political. But that's what I was interested in. And I think it's not like a time-stamped story of what happened when, although it's partly about that contest to be who would be the nominee, but it's more about Pete's kind of battle against himself. What are my weaknesses? What are my strengths? How do I become a better candidate? For him, it's how does he become more emotional and access a part of himself that he's kept protected? That was pretty interesting personal struggle that we saw behind the scenes. And so I think that's, there's a kind of universality to that story. That makes the film and will make the film relevant, I think.
Being the documentarian, how much different is the expectation with this documentary as opposed to your other works that you've had?
Well, the great thing about unscripted filmmaking is you kind of have to let go of what you think the story is going to be and just let it be what it is. And that can be frustrating, but it's also really exciting. There are things that come at Pete, curveballs in the story that he didn't see coming, we didn't see coming. But I love that about this kind of documentary storytelling. We are right there in real time when the S word hits the fan. And that's there's no substitute for that's real life drama. And man, the stakes are high, right? When you're running for president, like one wrong move and you're screwed. So I love that kind of storytelling. It's a bit of a grind. I mean, it was like chasing a candidate around for a year is pretty rough. And I'm not sure my family would let me do it again, but I think it was worth it.
And how many fist clenching moments were there? I know whenever you do an interview, you know, you always hope for a certain response or something. How many fist bump moments did you have that you were like, yes, we got that?
One of the things about Pete as a candidate person, you know, he was doing a lot of press and he would fall into habits, patterns that we had to kind of diffuse and get around. And I actually enlisted his husband, Chasten, in some ways to help me get around his defenses. And that's just one of my strategies. I wasn't sure if it was going to work, but it kind of did. And that was, I didn't have a big crew. So I wasn't like I could just fist bump my crew. I was mostly shooting the movie by myself, which is a great way to do this kind of work, I think. But it also means like, you don't really have any comrades in arms. So I did a lot of remote fist bumping with my wife, I guess, back home in California. She's my producer too. So she was dialed into everything that was happening.
That's awesome. Well, again, the new documentary, Mayor Pete. Jesse, I want to make sure and let our listeners know where they can find the documentary, download that, and also everything else you've got going social media wise, sir.
Yeah. Amazon Prime Video. It's up on the platform this Friday. So, if you're a Prime Video subscriber, you can find the film there and, around the world. And I'm on, of course, on Twitter, Jesse Moss. And there'll be a lot of conversation, of course, about Pete himself making news in Washington and the film as it comes out in the world starting this Friday on Prime Video. So, yeah, thanks, Cameron.
All right. Again, check it out this Friday. Mayor Pete, Jesse, great to visit with you, sir. I hope you have a great rest of your week. Look forward to release night.
Thank you very much.
A new study has zeroed in on the perfect time to fall asleep for your heart. And no, it isn't 1:48 a.m. after three reruns of Shark Tank. Researchers say the sweet spot for falling asleep is between 10 and 11 p.m. To come up with this time, they tracked and analyzed data from more than 88,000 adults over 6 years. They found there's a 12% greater risk of cardiovascular disease among people who go to bed between 11 and 11:59 p.m. and a 25% higher risk among people who fell asleep midnight or later. Night owls weren't the only ones affected. Falling asleep earlier than 10 p.m. was associated with a 24% increased risk of heart disease. Researchers don't have all the answers for these results, but they suspect that our body's internal clock, its circadian rhythm, gets disrupted by going to bed either too late or too early, and that has adverse effects on our heart. For the record, the study did take into account things like sleep duration, sleep irregularity, being an early bird or night owl, and other factors. And the results still said that the best time to go to bed is 10 to 11 p.m. Got a new book and a soundtrack that goes along with it as well, entitled Bow Monster. We've got guitarist extraordinaire Jesse Dayton on the line with us. And guitarist Jesse, first off, your name's still Jesse. Good to visit with you. Appreciate you taking some time.
Absolutely, man. Thanks for having me.
Now, tell us when the idea for a book and a memoir, when did that idea come from for you, and how cool is it to have it out in hands of readers today?
Well, it's really exciting to have it out and to put it in my hands, you know. But the book came about because Ben Schaefer over at Hachette and Arenda Laurel, who's my literary agent, I guess you call her that, they offered me a book deal right before the pandemic, right before the proverbial rug got pulled out from underneath the universe. So I spent like 19 months going back through all of these musicians that I worked with, and actors and filmmakers, and put together this 82,000 word book. And then I was like, well, you know, I owe the label a record. And, you know, I haven't been on tour in 19 months. So I went in and made this kind of companion record with the book of all the people that I'd worked with. So I'm really proud of it, man. It's kind of shocking. I woke up this morning and Chuck D, the rapper, and Glenn Danzig, who's like this punk metal icon, mm-hmm. they'd both reposted about my book this morning. So it's kind of exciting.
And when you talk about that, your music and your guitar playing has been featured across so many different genres. And how much pride do you take in that, to have that ability that translates regardless of genre?
Well, I love that you asked that question, because it's a really big pride thing for me, because I really don't like being defined by, you know, whatever. I mean, I've worked a lot in country music. I've worked a lot in rock music, but I've also done other stuff. I've done Zydeco stuff. I've done blues stuff, you know, played Western swing, played jazz, you know, all that stuff. But you know, I mean, I grew up on the Texas Louisiana border. I've been living in Austin forever, for 25 years, but I grew up on the Texas Louisiana border, and it was a gumbo of music. And, you know, my parents were the first ones to kind of make it out of the oil field and go to college, which afforded me, you know, a lot of, you know, different stuff, traveling and books and music and things that maybe a lot of the, you know, kids in my town didn't get. So that all kind of played a big part in me being able to walk into different situations, whether it was, you know, I mean, I played 2 weeks ago with Glenn Danzig on this Danzig Sings Elvis thing. And then, you know, right before the pandemic, I played with Lee Scratch Perry on a Jamaican thing. And, you know, so it doesn't matter if it's Rob Zombie or Johnny Cash that I'm working with, you know, it's all about finding the truth.
And Jesse, how long did it take you to feel comfortable dropping the names that you've worked with? Did it take a while before you had to maybe pinch yourself to realize that this really is real?
I mean, you know, at the end of the day, famous people just want to do good work and go home like everybody else. You know, it's not, you know, and I also believe that if you've worked with people, if I'm not talking about opening for them three bands apart on a festival, I'm talking about like in the studio, working with them on a recorded thing that's going to be around a lot longer than you or that artist are going to be around. You just kind of get to the point where you're like, wow, that was cool. I mean, I'm always a fan. I mean, I've never met a musician who's not a bigger fan than they are a musician.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Billy Gibbons can sit around and talk about Lightnin' Hopkins and East Texas Blues for hours. He's a huge fan. So I'm sure that, you know, when the Stones met Muddy Waters, they were freaking out a little bit. So yeah, I've totally freaked out before, but I wait until I get the work done, you know.
Now, who was the one that you worked with that really, really inspired you or made you realize that you were on the right track?
Waylon Jennings would be the guy. I mean, Waylon was the coolest. I mean, I can't impress upon you. You know, Johnny Cash had this amazing spiritual aura around him, and Willie Nelson, I mean, come on, he's an icon. But Waylon was the guy who was just still had this kind of dangerous, kind of wild, I'm going to do whatever I want and no one can do anything about it kind of attitude. And after I worked with him, I started just kind of not caring about what other people thought about genres and stuff like that as much. So he had a massive effect on me.
And Jesse, I want to make sure and let our listeners know, like we mentioned, the soundtrack going along with the book that's available and how cool it is to put those works that you've worked with that go along with the book. Was that intended whenever you started out, or was it just something that came while you were working on the book?
It came while I was working on the book. We never thought, you know, it's like, you know, a lot of these people that you see that are, you know, doing well in their careers or, you know, it just kind of comes as, you know, it was never a grand scheme for, you know, to plot this all out. And I was just like, oh, wow, it'd be kind of cool if I did songs by everybody that I wrote about in the book and just kind of did them my own way. And, you know, because I have this kind of underground cult following and I knew that they would dig it if we went in and recorded. So yeah, there's a Waylon song, there's an X song, or there's a Super Sucker song, there's a you know, just all kinds of different Towns Van Zandt song on there. And anyway, it was a lot of fun.
That is awesome. And again, Beau Monster, the memoir and the soundtrack available now. Jesse, I always want to make sure and let our listeners know where to pick up the book, the album, and also keep up with you social media wise as well, sir.
Yeah, absolutely. Tell them to check me out. My Instagram account's a lot of fun because I've got a lot of the pictures that I've worked with people. But they can find me at jessedayton.com. But my Instagram and it's a lot of fun. It's kind of blowing up, and it's great to see people's response to all this genre bending.
That's good stuff. Well, Jesse, you will have a new Instagram follower as soon as I finish this one up too. But it's been great to visit with you, man. I'm looking forward to spending some more time with the book and the soundtrack myself. And brother, hopefully we can catch up again real soon.
Hey, great to talk to you, man. And I love Oklahoma, man.
Now, the only saving grace here is a lot harder to hoard frozen turkeys than it is to hoard toilet paper. A new report found that there's already a shortage of a lot of Thanksgiving staples, so they could become harder and harder to find over the next 2 weeks. Supermarkets started stocking up early because of supply chain issues, but they still might not have enough to meet demand. And here are five Thanksgiving foods that are already harder to find than usual. Number one, whole turkeys. Now, grocery stores only have 39% as many as they normally would right now. So if you've got room in your freezer, might be a good idea to snag one. Number two, cranberry sauce. Around 80% of the normal stock, and it's dropping. Number three, yams and sweet potatoes. Stores have about 75% as many as they normally would. Number four, stovetop stuffing, and generic brands too. Now, we might be okay on that one though, because supplies are currently at 88% of normal levels and rising. And number five, pre-made refrigerated pies. They could be sold out around Thanksgiving. Frozen pies should be a little easier to find, though. It's always good to have friends of the show back on with us, and we've got a singer, songwriter, got a new single called Lucky Star. Our good friend Bly back with us, and good to see you, my friend.
Hey, it's good to see you too, man.
Now, I know last time we talked, I think you were just finishing up your senior year. Am I right?
Yes. Last time we talked, yeah, I was senior in high school. Now I'm a freshman in college.
So you went from the top all the way back to down to the bottom again.
All the way
again.
Back down to the bottom. Oh, yeah.
Now, what was this summer like for you, and how excited are you release week?
Release week is going crazy right now. I'm itching for this. I mean, it's been released. You know, people are getting good traction on it. My monthly listeners went up on Spotify, so that's always a good sign. Got new followers. We did a little bit of promotion for it at a open mic night. Mm-hmm. And they got me to do a feature, and I did that, sung three songs, sung Lucky Star, and they loved it. And so that was during release day, October 29th. So we had a little mini release party without them even knowing it. And then we're looking forward to this November 13th release party. But the summer leading in from senior year high school to freshman college, it was a big transition because I'm down at ACM at UCO at Bricktown, the contemporary music program that they have. And that is completely different because my classes are like 12 in the morning and then, or not like, yeah, noon and then 4 o'clock. So it's like spaced out. And then the next day I'm all free except for one lesson. And the next day is same exact as Monday. It's a whole ordeal, but I mean, I'm loving it so far. It's where I need to be.
That's right. And learning the contemporary music, I mean, how much has that helped you in maybe writer's block, coming up with new ideas as well?
Right. It's helped me a lot. Music theory is very difficult for me right now.
Yes, it is.
Because I hear a lot of stuff. I taught myself how to play the piano by ear. I never looked up anything. I just played it. And so whenever, like, taking what I hear and putting it on paper in like a language form, it's hard for me to get that, but I'm slowly getting it, and I'm doing everything I need to do to get that done. But it's definitely helped my writer's block a lot, because I was sitting down and writing a song the other day, and I was thinking I need a chord to do that, but we're talking about like the circle of fifths, and there's always a fifth relative away from a chord that you can go to, and it'll be within the rules. And so I used that, and I was like, holy crap, I never even thought I could get that chord progression by using just a simple chart, you know.
See,
it's really cool.
That's what happens when you decide to follow the rules instead of breaking all the rules. I mean, you can break some of them, but you got to keep some of them in there, right?
Right, exactly.
Yeah, you talk music theory, that's a whole different ball game for most people. For people that they listen to music, they think they know music, and you start talking music theory, that's worse than like calculus for some folks.
Yeah, it's crazy.
The single release party coming up, and in Tipton for you as well. I know this has got to be extra special to get back to Tipton, have this release party. Tell us kind of what the plan is for Saturday night.
So Saturday night, November 13th at 8 o'clock, we're having a single release party down at Tipton at the 104. It's a little event center. It's not, I mean, it's a pretty nice place. I love it. It's a good venue spot where cornhole tournaments go on all the time.
Right.
And we have a strong following in Southwest Oklahoma, a lot of family there too. And so we're decided that's where we should do the single release, get good crowd there, get, you know, shake some green off me a little bit, try to get my live performance repertoire up to date, if you want to say that. But it'll be a lot of fun. It'll be a great experience for me and my band.
Getting used to the live performance, what have you been doing the last couple of weeks getting ready for the live show?
Last couple of weeks we've been rehearsing nonstop. We have I say nonstop, but we have two rehearsals a week within the past 3 or 4 weeks, trying to tighten up the set and trying to make sure that, you know, like certain accents are accented during a song, or in my original songs, like, because my original songs are all track based so far,
right?
You know, during live performances, you want to get that same feel. So we have work on those stops, make sure that it sounds like the track in some places, but also make sure that it still has that live sound where it's, you know, it's all creative still and everything's in the moment, you know. But we have a pretty good set so far. You know, it's mainly covers right now. I don't have many songs in my set, but it's getting, the more we work on it, the more we're tuning it up and the more originals we're putting in there and the more confident we're getting. So
now how has the songwriting been going for you as of late with everything else so jam-packed? Has it had to take a little bit of a backseat for a little bit?
It has. Yeah. Especially since, cause I had my job and it was going great. And then school started and then those two started being a major priority because I need money and I need an education and all that stuff. And then every now and then I'll sit down and write a song, and it won't even be, I won't like sit down and write a complete song. I'll write a verse and a chorus and then come back 2 or 3 days later, finish the song maybe, or I might span that song over a month trying to get, you know, write it every now where I can. But yeah, it's definitely been a second nature for me now since my schedule got busier.
Now, how has the music theory, as you get started in that, what's the biggest thing that you've pulled from that you've been using?
Oh, the biggest thing I would say is rhythm. I'm starting to notice, like, whenever I'm thinking of a melody, if I play a piano melody and then I'm trying to sing something, I'll be able to get like a rhythm on like where the words should be. That's usually different from the type of like R&B that is usually heard now.
Right.
And so it's usually more towards rap, and you can have those rap qualities in modern day R&B, but just some rhythms make things sound just different. And so I've been trying to get those rhythms using like 16th notes on where like I start singing and 8th notes on where I start singing, if it's like a downbeat or if it's an upbeat. So I started messing around with that, and I'm starting to get some cool results. So
that's cool. Now, what instrumentation is the biggest challenge for you? Is it the drums? Is it the beats?
Beats is really, that's a difficult spot. That's probably where all my stuff is probably the beats, but piano comes pretty easy to me. I can hear pretty much anything I need to on there. Just, technology is not my friend right now.
I understand that all too well. Now, how has the social been going as of late?
It's been going great. My social media has been booming. Not booming, but it's gradually getting up there, gradually getting new followers. More people are reaching out to me wanting to collaborate. So that's really cool. I have some open windows that I might go through, and starting from the ground up. So it's a long process, but it's slowly getting where it needs to be.
And with you doing school, like you said, the schedule being a little more open, how has that allowed you to maybe take a little bit more ownership of your time and of your talents as well?
Like on Tuesdays, I have a full day of work that I can get to. And then I have one lesson that's at like 3:30. And then the rest of my day is off. So mainly on Tuesdays where I can kind of get creative, because my classes end on like 5 on Mondays and Wednesdays, so that's a little bit later. And then I'll get home, I'm a little exhausted, but it has been able, since those time differences, I've been able to get a good maybe like hour or two in on music instead of like branching 30 minutes here, 15 minutes here, or having to do something. That way, whenever my day is done, I have a lot of extra time that I can kind of crack down and hone in on something.
Is your writing process, is that better early or is it better late? Are you a night writer or are you a early morning writer?
I'm really like a night writer. It depends, I'm more of a night writer, but if I get wild hair about me, then I might write during the day. But I usually start getting like a song idea when I'm doing something routine, like if I'm washing the dishes or if I'm putting away my laundry or cleaning my room, that's when my mind will start going, and then I'll start to write something. I'll get creative.
So do you hear your dad's voice urging you to write? Because it's like, hey, boy, you got to get the trash out. You got to get right, the laundry yeah. done. Got to get the dishes oh, yeah. done. Oh, yeah. And while you're at it, write a song, right?
You got to get these chores done. You got to make some money, man. You got to make those number one hits.
Now, how cool is it for you to share the show coming up on Saturday with being not only your hometown, but the hometown of your family and has been for a while as well?
Yeah, that Frederick Tipton area has been in my family for a long time, and that Manitou area too. That it's really cool to be able to show my family kind of what I do, because granted, they know that I'm a musician and they know that I do R&B music, and it's different from our family because everyone else is like country.
Right.
But this showcase will really show like what I can do as far as my musical ability, as far as what covers I'm doing and my originals. Because some of them have heard my originals, but they haven't heard like what I can, you know, they don't know what type of musician I am. So they'll really see how well we can get down on Saturday, you know. Hopefully they'll back my single up a little bit more. Yeah, it'll be nice. It'll be a good showcase.
That's cool. Again, that showcase coming up Saturday night, 8 o'clock. Things get underway at the 104 there in Tipton. And Bly, always want to make sure and let our listeners know where to get the single, where to keep up with you on socials, website, all that as well.
The single is called Lucky Star. I'm on every single platform, capital B, capital L, capital Y. I'm on, you know, Spotify, Pandora, Apple Music, Amazon Music, everything. And as far as social media goes, you can find me at just_BLY on Instagram. And I think that's Facebook as well. Oh, no, I have a Facebook that is just BLY. And then my Instagram, just_Bly. Snapchat is BLY Gomez. And I think that's about it. Oh, TikTok is just_Bly as well.
Yeah, you can't forget the TikTok.
I can't forget the TikTok nowadays. That's the thing.
Well, Bly, always great to see you, have a chance to visit. I know both of our schedules were a little crazy last week, but right. I'm glad we were able to get it in today. And brother, I hope you have a great showcase coming up Saturday. And brother, we'll have to catch up again real soon.
Thanks, Cameron. I'm looking forward to seeing you, man.
The dating site Plenty of Fish just put out a fun list of new dating trends they expect to see in 2022, and they came up with names for all of them. They polled 7,000 single people and say these are all dating trends that are already happening. Number 1, communidating. That's using dating apps not just for dating and intimate relationships, but also to make friends and connections. Number 2, deja vuing. That means doing the same things with a new partner that you did with your ex. Number 3, handticipation. Being unsure about the physical boundaries that are acceptable, like whether to hug, shake hands, or fist bump your date. Number 4, hesitating. That's being unsure if you want to date seriously or casually, because life is so weird and uncertain right now. Number 5, resigning. That's ending a serious relationship due to perspective and clarity gained through the pandemic. Number 6, Darwining. That's refusing to date someone who doesn't believe in science. A third of single people say that they know someone who's done it. And number 7, Vacations. That's taking someone you just started dating on vacation because, well,
YOLO. Got a brand new single featuring the great George Jones. We've got Jason Bird on the line with us. And first off, Jason, it's a privilege to have the chance to visit with you, brother.
Well, thank you for having me, man. I really appreciate that.
Now, first off, I wanted to know, where did your correlation, your that relationship that I know that you had with George, where did that start? How long of a relationship did you have before you guys ever even got into a studio for this project?
You know, I met George back in the early 90s through a friend of mine in radio. He, Conway Twitty, and Vern Godson came to town to do a show, and my buddy ran into Nancy, George's wife, backstage and was telling her about me. I'd just done a demo. And she said, hey, I'd love to hear it. So he mailed her up a copy of it. And a couple of weeks later, you know, she reached out to me and said that she and George had heard the demo and really liked it and wanted to get with me to see how they could help me, you know, with my music career. And I made a trip to Nashville to see them. And after that, you know, she was managing me and we just hit the ground running. So we were friends, you know, from that point forward right on until the time that he passed away in 2013, and I'm still close with Nancy today.
Now, where did the song Better Life, where did this song originate for you as well?
I wrote the song back in 2004. I got the idea from it a couple of years earlier at my grandfather's funeral. The preacher was talking about the dates and the line on everyone's tombstone and everything, and made it a point to let everybody know that the line is really important, because that was why we were all there. You know, that's what made him. And I just thought it was really cool and kind of kept it in the back of my mind. And a couple of years later, I was just sitting around the house one day and it just started kind of coming out. So I grabbed my guitar and went in my studio here at the house and wrote it. It just kind of wrote itself in a little bit of time. So that was that. And I got in there working on that project in 2007 and recorded that song. It wasn't my intention for it to be a duet, but George happened to stop by the studio that day, and he heard it and liked it, and I asked him if he'd go in there and do the second verse and everything, and he said yes, so he went in there and did his part, and that's what got us here today.
What was that experience like? And then now to be able to hear that out on the radio waves, I mean, does that well up the pride in the chest, if you will?
I've always been proud of it. I joke and say, you know, I got my first George Jones cut and a duet with him in the same song, you know, which is pretty good. You know, every writer wanted a George Jones cut, you know. And, you know, maybe I cheated a little bit by getting it because we were buddies, but still I got it. But I held on to it, you know. I had it, and I was going to put it out, and then, you know, our label went bankrupt at the time and everything, so it just kind of sat there forever. And then after he passed away, I kind of thought about doing it then, but I didn't want anybody to think I was trying to take advantage of his passing or anything like that, so I just held on to it for a little bit longer. And when we went back in to do this project that we're working on now, I knew that I was going to have to do that, so I went back in and recut my vocals on it, and we remixed it and mastered it and everything, and released it to radio. So I was happy for it to finally get out there, for people to be able to hear George Jones again and to, you know, introduce him to me too, you know, because he did that in an effort to help me, and I appreciate it. And I didn't want to be selfishly holding on to that forever.
And Jason, the timeliness of the wording of the message of the song, probably not much better times than right now we're living in, right?
Oh, man, yeah, you're telling me. It's a deep song, you know. It takes you on a journey. And that's what I feel like music should do. You know, music is supposed to be therapeutic, and life's not always happy, and it's not always fun, you know, and you need to, you know, you don't realize just how much that can mean to somebody that's going through a similar situation, to know that somebody else is going through it and has come through it and things like that, you know. So this is kind of one of those songs, we're all going to deal with this one day, you know, and I'm just happy that it's finally getting out there for people to hear. And I actually got a message yesterday that a lady's mom had passed away yesterday, and that was one of the last songs that she played for, and it meant a lot to her, and that means a lot to me. You know, it's more than just you know, showbiz and money and things like that. You know, it's actually, you know, touching people's lives, and that's something that I really hope that my music, you know, especially the serious songs, can do.
And how hard is it sometimes as a musician, as a songwriter, to look at the music without looking at the dollar signs as well? I mean, I'm sure that sometimes you get so business oriented, but what's that like for you?
Well, it's not that hard these days because there's not nearly as much money in music as there used to be, you know, at our level. But no, it's not about the money. You know, I talk about this all the time with people. You know, obviously I want to be able to cover my expenses and stuff, but if this business and my music and things like that can self-sustain the business and get me out there to where I can play in front of people and they enjoy it and everything else, that's what it's all about. So it's not about making a buck for me. You know, I do want to, you know, not go into the hole, but at the same time, I don't have to be a multimillionaire to feel like I'm successful in this business.
And for you, where do you draw most of your songwriting? Where does that come from for you?
It's mostly through life experiences, you know, or other people that are close to me's life experiences, or just anything that I see in life, you know. And you know, I do a lot of songs that you know, can have kind of a little bit of a funny flair to them, you know, but they're based on real life too, you know, so it kind of makes light of some topics. And then there's others that there's just no way of getting around it. They're just going to be real and they're going to be emotional, you know, and that's just the way that those songs live, you know. But most of the songs that I write are based on life experiences.
What's the hardest part of a write for you? Is it getting started, or is it maybe being able to say, okay, we're done, without any more edits?
You know, a little bit of both. Sometimes it's hard getting started, you know, and then, you know, you just sit there and sit there and sit there. And on those days, I'm like, all right, I'm just going to go find something else to do because I don't want to force it, you know. But then at the end of the day, whenever you do finally have something down and you think that it's as good as it's going to get, you know, it is hard to walk away from it and not keep messing with it. You know, it's kind of like, I don't know if you guys do a lot of hunting there, but you know, it's like deer hunting in the morning. It's hard for me to go deer hunting in the morning because I feel like if I get down now, that deer's gonna walk out about 5 minutes after I get down, you know. And it's kind of the same way with a song, whether it be writing it or recording it, you know. It's like at some point you do have to stick a fork in it and say that it's done, you know.
For you, the music, was country always in your heart? Was that where you always knew your comfort zone was?
Oh yeah, country has always been a big part of my life. You know, I've always, that's been my favorite genre of music for my entire life. You know, now I do like other types of music. You know, I like good music, and it doesn't really matter to me what genre it's in. If it's a great song and it's done well, then I like it. You know, but as far as anything that I'm going to do, it's going to be country music. And if I have to choose between one or the other genre, it's always going to be country music.
That's cool. Now, again, we talked about the new single, the duet with the George Jones called Better Life. I wanted to give you an opportunity. I know that this has been out there and about, got a video and some other streaming opportunities for folks to check out as well.
Yeah, we just the other day released the lyric video. That's on YouTube. You can find that on YouTube. And it's on all of the digital service platforms, you know, iTunes and Spotify and all that stuff, where people can go and listen to it there. And it's also at radio, you know, which, you know, and, you know, just all I can say is, you know, if they like what they hear and want to keep up with me, you know, they just need to visit me on my website, jasonbirdmusic.com. And it's got links to all of that stuff on there. And just keep calling your radio stations and streaming those songs. You know, we just need them to pick up as much speed as they can so we can get out there to see you guys sometime.
That's right. Well, we would love to make that happen. And again, check out the new single. Check out the lyric video as well. Better Life featuring George Jones. And Jason, it has been great to have the chance to visit with you today. I love the single. As soon as the first time I heard it, before I was done with it, I was already emailing your folks saying, we got to get that guy on the phone. So,
well, I appreciate you for doing that.
That's awesome. Well, Jason, again, thank you so much for your time. And yeah, look forward to seeing you in person sometime real soon.
Same here. And thanks for having me. And hopefully we'll get to talk again soon.
Well, thanks again for joining us for this 149th episode in season 2 of Good Questions with Cameron Dole. If you ever have a comment, a question, maybe anything else you'd like to know, you can hit me up on the contact page at gqwithcam.com. You can also find me on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, and Facebook at gqwithcam. If you'd like to help out in the funding for this podcast, you can visit our merchandise store where we've got hoodies, shirts, tumblers, mugs, stickers, backpacks, and more, gqwithcam.com/shop. And if you have a special guest idea, email me, Cameron@gqwithcam.com. Do want to say thanks again to our good friend Brandon Allen for coming up with our theme music. We're going to let him play us out and hope you guys have a great rest of your evening.